Welcome to Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host, and with me as always is my co-host, Robin.
Hello!
When it comes to modern filmmakers, few can compare to the talent of producer, writer, director, cinematographer, and editor Steven Soderbergh. Soderbergh is unbound by genre. He wears many different hats, and he even alternates between big-budget, star-studded blockbuster crowd-pleasers and micro-budget independent films starring casts of complete unknowns. His films are stylish and sometimes baffling to the point of leaving his critics scratching their heads. And now, with his latest film, Side Effects, in theaters, Soderbergh has announced that he plans on retiring to make way for a new generation of filmmakers. Naturally, we here on the podcast are unable to ignore such an opportunity to look back upon the career of a filmmaker, and so on this episode, we'll be sharing our top five favorite Steven Soderbergh films as we try to classify the director who defies classification. Right after these messages. The Back Row has a PayPal account, and we're accepting donations. If you feel like throwing some of your hard-earned dollars our way, you can do so at The Back Row. Just go to the-back-row.com and click the donate button in the right column. If you donate, you can choose a movie for us to review and even specify which of us gets to review it. Doesn't that sound like fun? So send us your pocket change and we'll review your favorite Steven Soderbergh movie. Shouts from the Back Row is available through iTunes. If you search the iTunes store for the Back Row podcasts, you can subscribe to our feed, which will not only get you your weekly dose of media culture from us, but also Tom Lando's all-original audiobook podcast series, Oathbreakers, and back episodes of our heavy metal podcast, Drop D Revolution, and our surreality podcast, The Tom Lando Files. Tell your friends and subscribe today. We like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, and just about everything else we've been doing. So, Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, I finally went to see Warm Bodies, the new zombie romantic comedy, and overall, I'd say my thoughts on it are pretty similar to the thoughts you gave about it a couple weeks ago. I thought it was a pretty fun time, but this is a movie that definitely, considering its very clever premise, should have been, like, so much more. I find it kind of ironic that the lead character in this is named R, because all I can think of is how much better this movie would be if it had been rated R. This is like a PG-13 zombie movie, and even though I cannot understand why they did it, just because they wanted to be like a romantic comedy that kind of appealed to like the female demographic, I don't think zombies work very well in the PG-13 environments. You can make conceivably any horror genre work in PG-13 if you have enough talent for it, but I think zombies is just very difficult. But I think the problem is that, like, I didn't mind that we didn't get a lot of gore and violence because it was PG-13, but the big problem is that there just was not a lot of suspense and menace to it, because this is kind of like a breezy hour and a half where you see a girl fall in love with a zombie, and they kind of come around, hang around for a while, and then it kind of comes up with this easy solution where the dead are just kind of, they miraculously cure on their own, where for unexplained reasons, the zombies start becoming human again and start feeling emotions. And it's decided that they can start living with the humans again because they will get better. And the only real villains in the film are like these creatures called the Bonies, which are basically like decomposed corpses that come up after you. But the problem is that they just don't have a lot of menace at all. They just kind of show up for a couple of action sequences, but they're killed off pretty easily. And while watching this, I remembered like for the other classic zombie comedies out there like Zombieland and Shaun of the Dead, even though they were comedies, they still knew how to generate suspense and tension. Like, you actually felt these characters could be killed, whereas here it's just kind of more of a laid-back tone. It doesn't feel like anybody's in any danger. And all you can think about is that there are a lot of cool ideas in here that should have been explored a lot more. So, I mean, it's a decent time way to kill an hour and a half, but compared to the other entries in the zombie genre, this one just doesn't measure up, and it really should have been a whole lot more.
I have very similar opinions on the film as you do, Robin. There's really no suspense in this movie at all. And as I said when I reviewed it on the podcast, it just felt like missed opportunity after missed opportunity. When you hear the idea of, you know, a girl and a zombie fall in love, the obvious thing to do is to have the conflict be that he's in love with her, but he still wants to eat her brain. Like, that seems like such an obvious conflict that they could inject into the script, but that is just never there. And another conflict that seems missed is, you know, R eats, I can't even remember her name. What's her name? Is it Julie? Yeah, it must be Julie.
Julie, for Romeo and Juliet.
Yes, of course. R eats Julie's boyfriend very early on in the movie, and you expect that to be a big point of conflict, but she never really seems scared of him. She never really seems to perceive him that much as a threat. And there are just a lot of really odd choices, too, that are completely inconsistent. At one point, where she's trapped in this airport that is, you know, swarming with zombies, and R is trying to keep her hidden and protect her, she's like, I'm getting bored, what are we going to do? And they decide to go just joyriding around the airport in a car. Well, that's all well and good, but why doesn't she just drive away? Like, why doesn't she just escape right then? It really didn't make any sort of sense at all. And then, later on, they use that same car to escape. And I just had, you know, I was so confused. Another good example of this is how R talks about how slow zombies are in his sort of internal monologue. But then the zombies are also really fast at different times. The movie can't even decide what kind of zombies to put in it. And, I don't know, it really, it's a harmless film, but ultimately I felt like they really were trying to cash in on the supernatural romance thing that sort of started with Twilight. And we've had other movies like I Am Number 4 and, you know, that sort of thing. It felt like a studio was trying to cash in on that, but without understanding the genre that they were, like, trying to use. You know, there are certain things about zombies that make them zombies. Even Stephenie Meyer, she may have screwed up vampires in a lot of ways, but she still had their desire to drink blood, which is sort of the essential trait to make something a vampire. Likewise, zombies need to eat brains, and while they do eat some brains in Warm Bodies, it's never really a tense situation. There's no suspense in this movie at all. And talk about lame villains. The Bonies, really lame villains. And also, John Malkovich, just totally wasted here.
Oh, I know.
His character really doesn't have that much of an arc. I had high hopes for this one, but, unfortunately it just turned out to be mediocre at best.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, I know that zombie fans are kind of, like, dreading this whole trend of how, like, Twilight is influencing a lot of horror films out there, and it's kind of like, keep them away from the zombie genre! Like, if you want to ruin the vampire genre, that's fine, but keep them away from zombies. But, I do know a lot about the original novel that it was based on. I don't suppose you've read it, have you?
No, I haven't.
Okay, because for all I know, maybe the problem is the source material, but, yeah, this definitely should have been a whole lot more. But on the other side of the coin, I saw a movie, another movie that surpassed expectations, and this movie has surpassed the expectations of pretty much everyone who's seen it, and that's Dredd, which of course was the new Judge Dredd movie that was released last year. And, this movie got surprisingly good, like, critical reviews, and everyone, including Gil, and pretty much every review I've read have said how it was so much better than they were anticipating, and I guess it's because, like, the Sylvester Stallone's original Judge Dredd was so bad that, like, people were kind of groaning, like, really, we're gonna try another Dredd movie? But this one is a lot of fun, and I think it made the wise decision to keep its storyline, like, very simple. Like, I don't remember Judge Dredd all that well, but I seem to remember it having, like, a really convoluted storyline, and it had annoying stuff like Rob Schneider as the comedic sidekick, but this is basically, like, the same storyline as The Raid Redemption, and that's all it really needs. It's Judge Dredd going into an apartment complex that's run by, like, a drug lord and pretty much killing everything in sight. Like, there are just so many cool, like, violent death scenes here, and I kind of wish I had gone to see it in the theater, because, like, I'm sure the 3D effects for it would have been really cool, like, the bullet bullets going through people's skulls in slow motion coming out right at you. And it's just a fun way to spend 90 minutes. And I was pretty impressed by Carl Urban, actually, because he doesn't take the mask off throughout the entire film. Like, I know Stallone took it off a lot when he was playing Judge Dredd, but Urban just keeps it on, but somehow he still plays like an entertaining character. It's not a character with a lot of depth, but he still makes it work. So, yeah, it's not a film that's gonna, unfortunately, it flopped at the box office, and I think just because the whole Judge Dredd Stallone fiasco just hung over people's heads that nobody was interested in this, but, everyone I know who's seen it has been surprised by how much they liked it. So if you like the Raid Redemption and you like 90 minutes of nonstop violence, then go and check out Dredd.
I honestly can't remember the last time I heard Tom Lando gush about a movie the way he gushed about Dredd.
Really?
Oh yeah, he totally loves Dredd. He thinks it's just one of the best movies ever. And honestly, I wouldn't say one of the best movies ever, but for a sci-fi action film that's just full of blood and does a good job of evoking the sci-fi action genre of the late 80s and early 90s, made popular by films like Total Recall. I think I may have said this when I initially reviewed Dredd on the podcast, but it's kind of amazing that Dredd is a better Total Recall than the Total Recall remake we got last year.
Yeah, that's so true.
But yeah, just like blood and bullets in this really dark, dystopic sci-fi setting. I really enjoy just about every minute of it. I can't say that it's like high art, but it is refreshing to see that much blood in a science fiction film that's not at the same time trying to be like really cerebral or something else. Dredd knows exactly what it is, and it just sort of goes for that.
Oh, and I should mention, it's also, screenplay was from Alex Garland, who did 28 Days Later, so I think, and Sunshine, so that obviously helped a very lot. So, fortunately, it flopped, so they probably won't make any more, but it was definitely a worthwhile movie. And, yeah, that's about all the major stuff I've been up to.
I took in a couple of films. The newest film I saw Jack the Giant Slayer, Bryan Singer's high fantasy film, a sort of gritty action. I hesitate to use the word gritty, but like an action adventure take on Jack and the Beanstalk. Now, it's odd. I can't say as I have ever held this like deep interest in the recent trend of doing these like dark versions of popular fairy tales. You know, it always seemed like a very obvious device to me to take these public domain properties like fairy tales and just do a new spin on them, fill them full of action. It doesn't take a lot of thought to come up with one of these premises. I've never really been that interested in the trend, and yet I've seen basically every movie that has come out in this wave of films. The most recent film, besides Jack the Giant Slayer, being, of course, Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters, which I absolutely loathe. Now, Jack the Giant Slayer, I had kind of high hopes for this one because it's directed by Bryan Singer, first and foremost. And you know what? Bryan Singer is not a bad director. I know a lot of people really didn't like Superman Returns. And after Superman Returns, Singer took this, like, extensive break where he hopped from project to project for a while. Now he's finally going to be returning for the next X-Men movie. But this Jack the Giant Slayer was essentially his first film in a number of years. And I was curious because Singer really hasn't done any fantasy films before in his career. And I mean, I like fantasy films well enough. And watching the trailer, it seemed like it was a very confused movie. Like, Robin, watching that trailer, who's the intended audience for Jack the Giant Slayer?
Yeah, I was confused by it as well, because I kept thinking this kind of looks like a kid's movie, but maybe not. Like, I know that it kind of performed under expectations at the box office.
Way under.
So yeah, obviously it didn't know its audience, and people were as confused as you were, probably.
I was, well, see, here's the thing is, I think the movie was confused. I think the marketing team was really confused about how to market it, because this is an action adventure movie, but it's rated PG-13. So this is meant for the 13 and up crowd, which is really odd considering it's based on Jack and the Beanstalk. Like, that's a really confusing choice, almost as confusing as Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters being rated R. Like, who the hell was that movie for? But what gave me this glimmer of hope when I saw the trailers for Jack the Giant Slayer is I was reminded of another fantasy film that didn't take itself too seriously and didn't know how to be marketed. And actually, it flopped in theaters, but had a big comeback in video and has since become one of the, like, seminal entries into the fantasy genre, that film being The Princess Bride. When I saw the trailers for Jack the Giant Slayer, I thought to myself, I wonder if this is going to be a Princess Bride situation, where it's a totally confused mess of a movie, mess of a marketing campaign, but the movie is actually really good. And, you know, it's fantasy, but it has a healthy dose of humor and a lot of really cool action scenes. And maybe, you know, maybe it'll be fun. Well, unfortunately, it was a bit of a mess. The movie did not quite work, and it's certainly not another Princess Bride. It felt like there were too many screenwriters, in a way. There were too many different ideas that were, like, introduced and discarded. Here's a minor spoiler for it. So Stanley Tucci plays this villain character who has a magical crown that can command the giants. And he wants to grow the magic beanstalk and get up to the land of the giants so he can command them. Why he wants to do this is never addressed in the whole movie. Why does he want to command an army of giants? I guess he just does. But the more confusing thing, and this is the spoilery part, he dies halfway through the movie. The giants just, like, kind of kill him, and then they take the crown, and that's it. That's it. The end of Stanley Tucci's game. He serves no purpose. They set him up in the beginning to be sort of like a Gaston-type character, like from Beauty and the Beast, where he's set to marry the princess, but the princess doesn't want to marry him, and he's also pretty evil. They set him up in that role, but it's like they didn't know what to do with him halfway through the movie, so they literally just killed him, and it was of no consequence to anything. I could just level this criticism at all the different characters in Jack the Giant Slayer. None of them have arcs. None of them have plot arcs. Not a single one changes or grows over the course of the movie. There's not a single thing that happens that changes the way any of them behave or any of them think of each other. Nothing. And that is probably the biggest weakness. I liked the production design. Ewan McGregor's character had the potential to be something really great. They could have very easily made him sort of like a Han Solo character or even like an Errol Flynn type character. A real swashbuckler. He had the potential. He even had the right style of facial hair. But they just didn't do anything with him. He didn't change throughout the course of the movie. It really didn't go anywhere. There was one scene, though, where he had this little moment, and I saw this potential, and I really loved it. At one point, our heroes get captured by the giants, and Ewan McGregor's character is selected to be eaten. So he's rolled up in a big blanket of dough and put on a tray that is then put into a massive oven. And Jack has to free him. It could have been a really great sequence if they'd done anything creative with it. But when Jack is cutting him out of the dough, his character says, Ewan McGregor says, I had this. I had this. Really, I totally had this. But somehow it all went so wrong. And it was just this brief little glimmer of a character there that is then never followed up on. I really wish that I could say more. It just seemed like there were a lot of things missing from the script. As our screenwriting teacher would have said, a lot of widows and orphans, plot threads that are introduced late in the game, or things that are introduced but never pay off. Jack has an uncle. You know, the fairy tale Jack and the Beanstalk, he's got a relative who sends him to sell a horse and cart, and Jack sells it for magic beans. Like, that's the whole inciting incident of the plot. And yet, Jack's uncle, he sends Jack to do that, and then basically leaves the movie. And he's never seen again, or nothing is ever mentioned. Like, it's just very confusing, and kind of a mess of a movie. People are calling it this year's John Carter, but Honestly, I prefer John Carter to Jack the Giant Slayer. I really hope this is not indicative, however, of what the next X-Men movie is going to be like. Bryan Singer directed X-Men 2, which is, in my opinion, the best X-Men film thus far. So I guess we'll see, but this really doesn't bode well for Singer's career, especially after so many people disliked Superman Returns.
He needs to do another horror anthology like Trick or Treat.
Yeah, really. No kidding. I loved Trick or Treat.
Yeah.
So confusing. The other film that I watched recently, and I'd seen it before, but it was really good to rewatch it. I had a chance to watch it on Blu-ray at my parents' place. It's the film Take Shelter, starring Michael Shannon. Initially, I thought that this was like just a really well-made movie, very atmospheric. This was on the first viewing, I was like, really good atmosphere, sort of a heavy film. Overall, like above average, but a good movie. I didn't love it. On rewatching it, I've totally fallen in love with this movie. Boy, it is such a well-made film. The cinematography, especially seeing it in such a high-definition image, it's absolutely gorgeous. And I watched this with my mother and with Caitlin, neither of whom had seen it before, and it was really interesting to see the reactions they had to this movie, because those reactions were so visceral. Both of them were just on the edge of their seats throughout the whole movie because of this impending sense of dread, this tension that just keeps building from scene to scene to scene and, like, never pays off. I was actually reminded a lot of my review of Amour, the Michael Haneke film that was nominated for Best Picture and won Best Foreign Film at the Oscars this year. It's this cinema of anxiety, this filmmaking technique whereby the filmmaker just makes the audience feel really uncomfortable. And at times, without even really knowing why you're uncomfortable. I was talking a lot with my mom about the film after it was finished, and she talked about how the director would linger on shots of people just doing everyday things, but he'd linger on them for just a little too long, and just that little trick instilled tension in the scene, because you start to think, wait a minute, I've seen all I need to see in this shot. Why is the director lingering on it? Is something going to happen to these people? And then it doesn't, but you're left with that tension, that feeling of anxiety. Michael Shannon is so awesome in this movie. Did he? I don't think he got nominated for anything for this one, did he?
No, this was completely ignored by the Academy.
Oh, massive snub. Talk about a massive snub. Take Shelter really deserved more than it got. I gotta say, the dream sequences in this movie are just so utterly terrifying. The image of it, like a rain of oil, this oily substance that's raining down on everyone. You know, it really is quite unsettling. There's also a brilliant moment where everything's in our protagonist's house seems to be in a state of free fall. All the furniture like floats up into the air, and you see this like intensity on his face, like he's being plummeted from a height, but you don't know how or why or what's going on. It is a film of unsettling feelings, but really just masterfully done. So if you haven't seen Take Shelter, I highly recommend it, because boy, you know, initially I thought it was just above average, but upon revisiting, man, it's kind of a masterpiece in my opinion.
Yeah, I saw it too and liked it quite a bit as well. And it's always satisfying when you see a longtime character actor like Michael Shannon finally get like a lead role, and then he just knocks it out of the park, because I thought he was terrific in this, because you feel for the character, because like he may be insane, but he genuinely believes that he's doing the right thing and that an apocalypse is coming. So you feel real sympathy for him, and he carries along the film really nice. I've only seen this movie once, but I'm anxious to see it again, because like you said, first time you appreciate it, but then second time you fall in love with it.
Yeah, you're right. The something so interesting about his character is that while you really, watching him, you feel like this guy's totally going off the deep end. Like, you really feel like he's going nuts. But, you understand where he's coming from at the same time, because it's all, like, all the crazy things he's doing, they're all out of this desire to protect his family at any cost. He'll protect his family at any cost. And, I mean, that's something that I really can sympathize with. I watched some of the making of featurettes, and while the director basically refuses to comment on the meaning of the ending, he and Michael Shannon talk a lot about how they wanted to create a film that taps into that innate sense of dread that everybody sort of has within them. That feeling like, you know, it's almost like the feeling you get when you come home and you feel like somebody's been in my place. Or, you know, the feeling like you're being watched, but you don't know how or where. Just those unsettling little feelings that we all experience in day-to-day life. Take Shelter really taps into that sort of sense of foreboding and then amplifies it to this sort of insane degree. So, yeah, big recommendation. And, boy, what a good movie. And then finally, it occurred to me, I didn't talk about The Walking Dead on the last podcast, and I don't think I talked about it on the one before that either, which sadly sums up how I'm feeling about the show right now. I can't say as I have a lot to say about it, but the most recent episode is one that is at least worth commenting on. It's not quite a bottle episode, but it's an episode that takes place outside the principal plot line of the show. And it's just Rick and Carl and Michonne going on this excursion to get supplies at a nearby town. It was a good setup for an episode. It was really nice to get some insight into Michonne's character for once, because they really had not been giving her anything to work with over the past few episodes. In fact, I don't think she said a line, you know, in the two episodes leading up to this one. But she's really, they gave her some good stuff to do at least. However, while the episode was decent, I think it was completely misplaced in this season. For one thing, it totally ruins the tension of the impending attack on the prison that the governor is about to engage in. He's already sort of engaged them once, but so you know this big attack is coming, and it's probably going to be the season finale. But does that mean that we just have to drag our heels and, like, go on this little side trip? It just felt like, don't they have something better to do? Like, maybe fortifying the entire prison because an army is about to break into it or something like that? But no, they don't do that. The other confusing thing is that the trip that they take, they go back to Rick and Carl's hometown. And it's less than a day away from the prison. Less than a day?
That does not fit in the geography of the entire series.
Not at all. And it's so confusing because it's like, wait a minute. Does that mean you guys spent an entire winter? Because that's what they said at the beginning of season 3, that the winter has passed. So they spend an entire winter just like within a day's journey of Rick's hometown? It is so confusing. And I don't know. Minor spoilers. So they go back to Rick's hometown and they find Morgan, the guy from the pilot episode, the black guy, one of Rick's neighbors, who he's sort of haunted because the zombie of his wife is wandering around outside and he can't bring himself to kill her. One of the finer moments of the series, frankly, all the way back in season 1. So they reunite with Morgan. Spoiler alert. And they just leave him there. Like, they meet up with him and they talk to him, and then they just leave, and he stays behind. In the comics, they actually take him with them. In the comics, they only stop by Rick's hometown because they're on their way past it going to a different destination. But it was so confusing to me. You know what this episode felt like? It felt like the season premiere of season 4. It didn't really fit at all with the pacing of the rest of season 3. So while it wasn't the best or worst episode of The Walking Dead that I've seen this season, it was a very strange choice to put it where they did within the chronology of the series and even within the geography of this story. Robin, have you seen any of the recent episodes of The Walking Dead?
Yeah, I've seen them all, and there have been some good points and some bad points, but I think you're kind of talking about the major problem here is that it feels like the beginning of like season four, and I'm thinking, well, that's like the 12th episode, I think, and this season is inexplicably 16 episodes instead of the traditional 12 or 13, so it feels like you're having these episodes in here to stretch it out to like 16 episodes, and all I can think of is like, they could have cut it down to 12 or 13 easily because and cut out a lot of the fat here. So, yeah, that is bizarre. It's almost like this is where the season was supposed to stop, but no, we're contractually obligated to have 16 episodes, so we're going to continue to stretch it out. So it's very weird chronology here.
Further evidence to support that theory is the idea that, well, the fact that this one was written by the show's new showrunner who's going to be taking over at the beginning of season four. So it's almost like he's just starting his job early. I don't know. I'm going to watch the rest of the season, but there have been a number of eye-rolling moments since The Walking Dead has returned from its mid-season break, and I really wish it wasn't so. This has been, as we've charted over the entirety of this podcast, this show has been a real, like, up and down for me. But I sort of feel compelled to keep watching, if only to continue chronicling my love-hate relationship with it.
Though I did feel it was kind of a breath of fresh air watching it this week right after I'd seen Warm Bodies, and I was like, well, at least this is a real zombie story here.
Yeah, you know what? I got to agree with you there. At least it was not – at least there was some tension. There was tension, there was suspense,
yeah.
And the characters developed and moved on. They didn't always make the best or smartest decisions, but at least things changed. It could have been a lot worse. It really could have been. And that's all I've been up to. Do you need a break before we dive in?
I think I'm fine.
All right. So now let's talk about the films of Steven Soderbergh. Before we get into our lists of our top five Soderbergh films, I thought it might be fun to just sort of look at Soderbergh as a filmmaker. You know, like I mentioned in the intro, he wears many different hats. He's a producer, he's a writer, a director, he shoots his own movies, he edits his own movies. Sometimes he shoots and edits under pseudonyms of like his mother and father's names and things like that. He alternates and like really alternates between doing these small independent films and these like big budget crowd pleasing blockbusters. He tackles really unusual subject matter from time to time. He's not afraid of reputation even. He's done movies that star known porn stars. It's really quite something to look at his filmography and try to piece together the different things that can identify a movie as a Steven Soderbergh film. And of course, that is sort of the defining tenet of an auteur, is that you can tell an auteur's movies just by looking at it without knowing that he or she is behind those films. So Robin, do you consider Steven Soderbergh to be an auteur?
Yeah, because he has just done such a wide variety of stuff over the years. Like, throughout the 90s, he was like the king of independent cinema. And then he suddenly started going mainstream and then doing movies that were finally winning Academy Awards. It seems that when he was nominated for Aaron Brockovich and Traffic, both in the same year, and then he did Ocean's 11, it's kind of like, yeah, he's pretty much set for life, so he can do whatever he wants. And through the decade after that, he's alternated between doing, like, really low-budget experimental stuff and then doing, like, a blockbuster and stuff. And I find that with a lot of independent directors is like once they get their big project that makes them a lot of money and sets them for life and gets them a lot of acclaim, they make projects that they want to make. Like they don't want to feel the pressure of the studio. And if they're in the mood to make a blockbuster, then they'll make a blockbuster. But they will not hesitate about making a movie that's not going to make them a lot of money, but it is a project that personally interests them.
And do you feel like you could recognize a Steven Soderbergh film without knowing that he was attached to it?
Sometimes. Like, sometimes he has kind of a distinct, like, visual style. Like, I think around the time he was doing, like, The Limey and Traffic and Out of Sight, he kind of had, like, kind of a distinct visual style, I think, that kind of made him make it look like a Soderbergh film. But if you were to watch something like, say, Bubble or The Girlfriend Experience, you would never guess it was him. It's kind of like he likes to use very distinct styles, I think, through different movies. Like even Magic Mike, when I saw recently, watching it, I forgot it was a Soderbergh film because there was nothing in it to indicate it was by this director.
Yeah, it really is quite amazing how he is quite a chameleon. And I love that he is even aware that he is this sort of chameleon filmmaker. In the Wikipedia entry for Steven Soderbergh, it says here, Soderbergh claims to not be a fan of possessory credits and prefers not to have his name front and center at the start of a film. The fact that I'm not an identifiable brand is very freeing, says Soderbergh, because people get tired of brands and they switch brands. I've never had a desire to be out in front of anything, which is why I don't take a possessory credit. I find it very interesting that even as a filmmaker, like, he wants to remain a bit of an enigma. He doesn't want to have a trademark style. He wants to be able to make whatever movie he likes and have that movie stand on its own merits, as opposed to it being judged as a Steven Soderbergh film. Now, all that being said, I do feel like his style is distinct enough to consider him an auteur. And it is a lot to do with his knowledge of the camera. I mean, ever since the beginning of his career with Sex, Lies, and Videotape, the idea of the camera has always been this thing that Soderbergh has been very aware of. His movies inevitably feature all of these cinematic tricks, you know, these ideas of using even stuff like using the point of views of security camera or long takes, these very long shots, lots of handheld stuff, and a lot of montage to the point he uses montage to the point where a lot of people have compared his style to like the French New Wave. But whereas I'm not a huge fan of the French New Wave, I am a very big fan of Soderbergh just because of how stylish he can, you know, he can use these very stylish things, but in a way that doesn't draw attention to themselves. It makes a lot of his movies seem very dreamlike, and I'm sure that's something that we're going to be talking about as we go on as well. Something else that I really love about Soderbergh is he has a sort of a nostalgic style. A lot of his films feel like they're trying to emulate the style of films of the past. Some of them feel like they should have been made in the 70s or the 80s, whereas some of them are like really sort of slick and polished. He's a very visual director, because saying that sort of makes it sound like he's all visual and, you know, he's all about the visual as opposed to the cerebral or something like that. But what I mean by Soderbergh is a very visual director is he is a director who is, like, he just understands the medium of film to the point where he does almost every aspect of his film, produces, writes, directs, shoots, and edits, and at the same time knows that he is not the brand and he wants to, you know, sort of step. He does everything, but he wants credit for nothing, which is, it's very interesting. But I would definitely consider Soderbergh to be an auteur. Do you, Robin, have any, as far, you know, I've talked sort of at length here about the visual flair of Soderbergh's films. Do you feel like his plots have any common threads? Maybe there's some themes that he likes to explore again and again?
I'm not sure, because he rarely ever writes his own films. Like, he's not like a lot of directors who like to do their own material, but I guess he kind of likes to tell like multiple stories about multiple characters and stuff, and he's unconventional, I'll say that. Like, sometimes you'll go in watching a movie expecting it to be something and it'll be completely different than what you expected it to be.
That's absolutely true. Now, because we're doing our top five, and I think Soderbergh has only really directed about 23 movies to date, not including his TV work, I suspect we're going to be talking, we're going to end up talking about a fairly large chunk of his filmography. So why don't we just get into it and we can tackle his common themes and our other thoughts on him as we go along. So Robin, what is your number five Steven Soderbergh film?
Well, my number five is The Informant, and this is the perfect example of a movie you go into thinking it's going to be something, and then it turns out to be something totally different than what you're expecting. I remember seeing the trailers for this, and it kind of looked like it was kind of another Aaron Brockovich film about a corporate whistleblowing, and then you start off the film and you see Matt Damon's character, Mark Whitaker, and you see that he's blowing the whistle on, like, price fixing at this company he works for, and you're kind of like, well, that's not really dramatically compelling. But then as it goes along, you realize that this is kind of like a screwball comedy, that the character of Mark Whitaker is just a pathological liar and is more corrupt than any of the corporate people that he's trying to turn in, and it just becomes quite hilarious. What's great about it is it's totally based on a true story, and so many of the events on this film you just would not believe if they were invented from scratch as fiction, but then you find out that pretty much they were all true, and it just blows your mind, just the way that he was able to con, like, so many people, the FBI and, like, his family and the company, while embezzling all this money, and he it's kind of subtle, the whole, like, screwball comedy element to it, because he'll go into scenes where he's playing, like, this goofy sitcom-style music in the background, which doesn't seem to fit the scene. And he casts, like, a lot of comedic actors in roles that you wouldn't expect. You see people like Joel McHale and Tony Hale and Patton Oswalt and the Smothers Brothers in these small roles, even though it kind of starts off as a serious drama. And you see Thomas F. Wilson, who played Biff in Back to the Future, in, like, a serious role. And you kind of sense that something is off here. And then that's what you realize, that he's doing this as a very dark comedy. And I think one of the great running gags about it is that, like, everyone is incompetent in this, like, not just, like, the FBI, like, the corporation, and, like, you find out that even though Matt Damon's character starts off as a good con man, he really isn't a good con man, because some of his lies are just so blatantly obvious that you wonder how he could get away with it. And the fact that he wants to, like, turn in, like, the people at his company and then expect to be promoted to the president after they all go to jail just shows how dumb and naive he is. And the movie was not a big hit at the box office, because it was completely not what people were expecting. But I just took it as a great Soderbergh project, that he wanted to do something very unconventional, even though it might not have mainstream appeal. And I liked it a lot. And I should mention, I have a soft spot for it because it has my doppelganger in it. People have said I look like Matt Damon, and in this movie he wears glasses and a mustache, so he looks a lot like me in this. So I remember seeing this in the theater and almost felt like I was watching myself on screen, so that's why I always have a soft spot for it. I think The Informant is really underrated.
I should also say that you're a lot smarter than yes. Matt Damon's character in The Informant. The resemblance is purely a visual one.
Yes,
I quite like The Informant. I felt like it was, it is a bit confused. Like, it is a bit tonally confused, and I do feel like that is really deliberate. You know, you touched upon how is it a whistleblower movie, or it's kind of like a dark screwball comedy, and you, while watching it, you get this feeling like, wait a minute, like, something's not quite adding up here. And, I do feel like, while that is, it's sort of like one of the film's greatest weaknesses and one of the film's greatest strengths, because by sort of defying the idea of classifying itself as a single genre, it means that you can get something totally unexpected and have that be a really refreshing experience. Just the idea of watching this movie and you think, oh, you know, another corporate whistleblower movie, and then it turns out that your main character is just sort of like this rampant buffoon. Like, he's just this unstoppable, stupid force. And there are so many scenes where, you know, he'll just say something really dumb, especially right as they're about to, like, go into a meeting or something. And he'll walk away and leave the other characters standing behind him, go like, wait, what? No, don't all, you know, they can't get a handle on him. He's too dumb and too enthusiastic and too corrupt for anybody to be able to control. And that's sort of what makes the character so compelling. He's really, like, he is this pathological liar, and at the same time, he is pretty dumb. Like, he makes a lot of really dumb decisions and doesn't think things through very much. And in a way, it's sort of like the perfect antidote to a very typical whistleblower movie, where the whistleblower character is shown as being, like, really smart, and, you know, the company is really bad, and they're like, crushing him down. But in The Informant, it's just sort of like he's this happy-go-lucky doofus who he doesn't think twice about the consequences of any of his actions. I also really like Joel McHale and Tony Hale in this as well. I want Tony Hale to be in more movies, so it was pleasant to see him in this one.
Yeah, I rewatched it not too long ago, and I was pleasantly surprised, because when I originally saw it, I had no idea who Joel McHale and Tony Hale even were, so it was so funny seeing them in serious roles like that.
Yeah, it's a really good one. So my number five, this is one, I get the feeling, Robin, this is going to turn off later on your list, and it's a film that I never would have been introduced to were it not for Robin's Underrated Gems, except this blatant plug.
Yes.
That film is, of course, The Limey. I had never seen The Limey. This one was made right around the time that I was starting to become aware of Steven Soderbergh, in the late 90s. I wasn't really familiar. To this day, I'll admit, I still haven't seen Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And, it was The Limey and another film that came out around this time that I'll be talking about later that really, it was the other film that brought Soderbergh to my attention, and I somehow just missed The Limey in the shuffle because I didn't know who this guy was. And so I only just watched it. I stopped, finished watching it about an hour before we were meant to. We started recording this, and I really love this movie. This is a film that, after I read the comparison to The French New Wave, watching The Limey, boy, could I see it. I could see it, like, definitely in The Limey, there's maybe one or two other films that I'll talk about where I could really see this French New Wave influence. But The Limey is great because it's like this sort of gangstery caper movie, lots of violence and like fast-talking characters. But at the same time, it's this very artfully done movie. There are, when I said, you know, Soderbergh's films are dreamlike earlier, this is the one that first came to mind because there are just so many interesting, it's constructed so interestingly. There are these little, like, flights of fancy that we see in characters' heads, particularly the one that I'm thinking of. It occurs, it's probably about a quarter of the way through the movie, maybe a third of the way through the movie. Wilson, the main character played by Terrence Stamp, is fantasizing about killing the character played by Peter Fonda, Terry Valentine, at a party. And we see all the different variations on his fantasy as he draws a gun and he shoots at Terry Valentine. And in one, he shoots him in the heart. And in another, he shoots him and he misses a bit and catches him in the elbow. And then in another one, he just blows his brains all over the wall. And each time, you think to yourself, okay, now this is the real one, though. And then it isn't. And then, you know, the real one happens and you go like, oh, wait, okay. But because you've seen sort of every variation, it leaves you with it leaves the impact in a very different way. You take the action to be very different than if it had just played out once and you know for sure that's it. The whole film is presented as these like disjointed flashbacks, and, what's interesting is it keeps on sort of flashing to Wilson on a plane. And as the film goes on, you sort of start piecing together where that scene of him on the plane takes place. But like at the beginning, I thought, okay, it's just flashing to him on the plane arriving at the beginning of the movie. But, as it turns out, it's flashing to him leaving at the end. It really is. There's just so much great montage. There's a really interesting montage that introduces Peter Fonda's character. That's just, it's so interesting. No other filmmaker would sort of ever dare to do something like that. And in a way, it's kind of like Soderbergh has even been tamed by the mainstream. And I'd be surprised if he did something as intricate as a weird little character montage like the ones that you see in The Limey. But I really love this movie. I thought this was really good. I really like Terrence Stamp. Luis Guzman is great here as well. Man, talk about community connections, eh? There's another one. Yeah. It's Soderbergh and Community somehow connected. I really like the plot. I really like the script. And Terrence Stamp really steals the show as Wilson. I especially love his Cockney rhyming slang that he uses throughout the film. He's my China, you know, my China plate, my mate. Or I'm going to butcher around. Butcher hook, you know, take a look. I really like those little moments. They add some great character to him. And Wilson is a very interesting character as well. Now, as I said, I'm sure you're going to be talking about this one later, Robin, because you introduced me to this film. But do you want to hold off your thoughts until later, or do you have anything to add now?
I'll get my thoughts when I get to it later, but I just say I'm really happy that you finally got a chance to see it, and I knew that as a film student you would love a lot of the techniques that Soderbergh uses in this. This is the movie that kind of it was his last experimental film before he hit it big with Aaron Brockovich in Traffic, so it's a really unique point in his career.
Yeah, really excellent. Very, very well shot, and once again, I gotta plug the Robin's Underrated Gems column on this, because not only do you give it a great review, but you feature in clips some of my favorite scenes. You know, I'm fucking coming.
Yeah.
that whole sequence is so well shot and so well acted that, yeah, I totally love the movie right from the get-go. So what's your number four, Robin?
My number four is his most mainstream film, Ocean's 11, where I remember when it originally came out, I had never even heard of the original Frank Sinatra version, so I was just kind of drooling at this trailer because, I mean, this is, I think from 1998 to 2001 is when Steven Soderbergh was just on fire, where, like, everything he did, he touched turned to gold, and this was kind of like the apex of his career, where he was just going to do, like, a fluffy mainstream Hollywood blockbuster with A-list cast, and he pretty much hit his peak for success here, or at least financial success, at least, and I was just remember watching the trailer and was drooling at like all the cast they assembled for it, seeing like George Clooney and Brad Pitt and Matt Damon and all these like unique characters together to perform like the ultimate heist. And it still is like a really a lot of fun. Like it's way better, I think, than the Frank Sinatra version, because compared to the original one, they really don't focus on the heist too often. They just kind of show like Frank and the Rat Pack kind of goofing around, but here they focus more on the intricacies of the heist. And I think this is like the prime example of a perfect remake to do, where it takes a premise that wasn't done well the first time around and then does a great job of it and greatly improves it, because like all the characters here, all 11 members, all have their own unique skill set and role, and like it keeps you guessing the entire time what they're gonna do, and it's a lot of fun to see the heist unfold. And even though there are some plot holes in it, I even cover one of them in one of my columns on crack.com, it is really like cleverly structured and put together, and each actor is utilized to the fullest. And I kind of thought the two sequels to it were mediocre, but this one holds up really well and is still one of my favorite heist films. And it shows that even though Steven Soderbergh, this is him going mainstream and doing like just kind of a Hollywood blockbuster, he still knows how to do it really well. Like it's really well shot and edited together. So yeah, this is probably like his most successful film, and it's still one of my favorites.
Well, you're never going to believe this, but Ocean's 11 is my number four pick as well.
Oh, perfect.
I think that that's really quite fitting for just if you look at Steven Soderbergh's oeuvre as a whole, the idea of Ocean's 11 being number four. Like, it's not the worst. It's not the best. But it's still really enjoyable. It is a genuine crowd pleaser. I mean, it has such a terrific cast that it's sort of difficult to go wrong. It's kind of amazing that Ocean's 12 and Ocean's 13 were not nearly as good. Ocean's 12 in particular, I consider it to be a pretty crappy movie overall. But, yeah, I mean, I guess the first time was a charm for this one, because Ocean's 11, it's really fun. All the characters are quite likable. I think this is sort of Clooney at one of his more fast-talking, charismatic bests. And I don't know, it also showcases a lot of actors in secondary roles who don't usually get sort of the attention that they often deserve. I'm thinking of, like, Elliot Gould. You know what's Elliot Gould been up to these days? They're really not a heck of a lot, but it was really refreshing to see him in a role here. I'm a big Casey Affleck fan. This is before Casey Affleck moved more and more into mainstream acting. He's certainly not as big of a star as his brother, but I really like Casey Affleck, and I thought he was really great here. And just the fact that each character is given enough time to give them a little bit of an arc. I mean, even if it's not a heck of a lot, it's still, they still just get enough of a moment that you care what's going on. And of course, the glitz and glam of Las Vegas, big old casino heist. I mean, man, is there any easier mark for a villain than a casino owner? Like, these are establishments that are literally designed to just take your money away. So of course, it's so satisfying to see, oh, somebody stole the money from the casino for a change. It is really clever. It's as you said, Robin, there are a few little plot holes here and there, but it's one of the better executed film heists. They let the audience in on the details of the heist just enough that you feel like you're in on the plan, but they still keep a few things hidden from you so that it's not just a total run of the mill when the climax happens. You, the audience member, are still surprised a bit. And they don't cheapen it either by having it be some complete deus ex machina, something that they never set up or something that took place outside the plot, which is in fact why Ocean's 12 doesn't work. The biggest problem with Ocean's 12 is the fact that the big reveal is, oh, the characters actually stole the thing, like, in the first act, and we just didn't show you. But this is the time that they definitely got it right. And it's flashy and it's fluffy, and it really is just this fluffy crowd pleaser. But it's not meant to be anything else, and you can sort of tell, even more so here, of course, more so in the first one than in either of the sequels, too, that all these A-listers were just having an absolute blast hanging out together and playing these con men. Like, it does sort of come off as like a Rat Pack movie, but in a way it's even better because here's a Rat Pack that they're just so, you can tell they're having such a great time, but they're also making a really entertaining and fun movie along the way.
That's what I heard is the problem with Ocean's 12, is that they just had so much fun together hanging out in Italy that they forgot to actually make a movie.
Yeah, that's totally it. What are your thoughts on the two sequels? I mean, you touched upon them briefly, but do you have any? Would they even make your top 10?
Maybe Ocean's 13 would. Like, it's a lot of fun, but it felt like the characters were getting together again and going through the motions, and there really wasn't a lot at stake. Ocean's 12, like, I just mentioned the same problem, is that basically, apparently Brad Pitt actually said that quote I said, where they all were having this fun time hanging out in Italy together, and he said, "Aw, poor Catherine Zeta-Jones, she actually showed up and thought we were actually making a movie. She was actually, like, practicing her lines and getting into character while we were all hanging out and partying," and that's pretty much the purpose, is that there's no real plot driving it forward. It's just the characters kind of going and doing a heist in Europe and just kind of goofing off for a bit, but there's nothing at stake here. The part of the film, though, I do like is the whole meta thing where Julia Roberts' character pretends to be Julia Roberts and then gets into, like, a meeting with Bruce Willis, who thinks she's the real Julia Roberts, but of course she's freaking out because she's not a celebrity and she's meeting Bruce Willis for the first time. I think that was kind of clever and very unconventional, but the rest of the movie was
I don't know. In a way, I found that kind of hackneyed. You know what, though? It really seemed, especially with Ocean's 12, like, even looking at the previews for Ocean's 12, I didn't bother seeing this one in theaters, whereas I did see the first one in theaters. But even just looking at the previews for Ocean's 12, you kind of felt like, this really has become, like, the Rat Pack. Now all these actors are just sort of like, well, where do we want to visit? Now let's all go to Amsterdam. We'll shoot a scene in Amsterdam. And then while we're there, we'll, you know, all get high and go to a nice museum. And then, we're off to Paris. And let's all go to Paris, and, you know, and it just, it goes on like that. The first one is still a really terrific one. And that's why it's my number 4 as well.
Yay.
What's your number 3, Robin?
My number 3 is The Limey. So now it's my turn to talk about it. Yeah, this is definitely one of my favorite Soderbergh films. That's why I made it a Robin's Underrated Gems thing. And this one has a really interesting story behind it. It actually, the DVD version has one of the most entertaining commentary tracks out there, because the screenwriter Lem Dobbs just kind of wrote it as like a straightforward like crime revenge thriller. And he was quite surprised that Soderbergh did all these fancy things with the editing and stuff like that, this like French New Wave stuff. And he was kind of pissed off about it. So they're actually like arguing together throughout most of the commentary track. It's quite hilarious and stuff, but I got to take Soderbergh's side on this, because he takes what could have been like a routine revenge story and elevates it with his like fancy filmmaking techniques. I really love the editing and the limey where he'll juxtapose between many different scenes, where it's like you'll have characters having a conversation in one location, and then they'll cut to the other location, and like then one of the characters is finishing off like one of his sentences and stuff, and then they'll just cut to like a scene in a different timeline where the characters are like carrying on the conversation. It's really unorthodox, but it's really well done and clever. And my favorite editing technique is how they take stock footage from this crime movie, this British crime movie that Terrence Stamp did in the 60s called Poor Cow, and they use it as flashback sequences to show like Wilson as like during his younger days, and it works well because you're seeing like a younger Terrence Stamp on film from another movie, and it works so well in the context of the story because it deals a lot with like Wilson's past and his relationship with his daughter, and it does so many unconventional things. And I actually like the ending of this where he finally tracks down Terry Valentine, and he's about to kill him for like being responsible for the death of his daughter, and then he finds out that he only wound up killing her by accident because she was about to call the cops on him for all his illegal activities, which is pretty much what she used to do with him when she was a child before he went off to prison. And he decides to spare Valentine because he realizes that they're both kind of the same, and that he's equally kind of responsible for what happened to her as well. So very fascinating stuff. And this is a movie, I know you've only seen it once, Gil, but you notice so many things when you go back and watch it so many times because of its non-linear editing sequences. And you, when you watch Terrence Stamp on the plane during the early scenes in the film, you look at it in such a different light, just because of now you know that he's on the way home and stuff, and that he's feeling a lot differently going back to Britain than he did on his way. So it's a really underrated performance by Terrence Stamp. I really wish he had gotten an Oscar nomination, because he plays it subtly, whereas in other scenes he goes really campy and over the top. Like I love the scene in the warehouse where it's basically one unbroken shot where like the bad guys carry him out and beat him up, and then he walks back in there in this one shot, and then you hear gunshots, and then one guy running out screaming, and then he has his then Wilson comes running out with blood over his face yelling, "Tell him I'm fucking coming!" Like, it's such a classic moment. This is really an underrated film that is kind of the end of Steven Soderbergh's independent phase when he kind of moved mainstream, but it's well worth checking out. It's one of his best films.
You're absolutely right. You touched upon some really fantastic moments, too. I can't wait to revisit it. As I was saying, like, he uses these great little montages and all these really interesting editing techniques, and I can't wait to watch this again and slow that stuff down and, like, take in every little shot that he puts into those. Some of them are really, like, rapid-fire montage sequences as well, and I'd really love to sort of break it down and study how it's constructed, because it's just so unique from a visual perspective, and that's what does give it this stylish flair that sets it apart from what it could have been, which is this, you know, or this revenge thriller. I love that the author is arguing with him on the commentary track. I really got to hear that, because that sounds fantastic. And it does sound like the kind of thing. I wonder how many screenwriters have arguments with Soderbergh. They're like, "You want to shoot this how? This is not at all what I thought this movie would be like."
That's worth mentioning that Lem Dobbs came back to write Haywire for him, so I guess they reconciled, though I wonder if he did a lot of things with Haywire that Lem Dobbs didn't approve of.
Yeah, well, hopefully he knew what he was getting into this time around. But, yeah, I love Terrence Stamp in this. I love that he plays the character of Wilson like he's kind of like a brick in a way. Like, he's not a really intelligent character, but he's not stupid either. He's got serious street smarts, and but because he's, you know, because he's so much more of this, like, former soldier, in a way, like, he was never a guy who was known for his smarts, so he struggles to find the right word in conversation, but he also, you know, has this one-track mind, and he has this moral compass, even though it may, you know, skew in a strange direction. It really is just a very interesting character to put at the center of a film because of how, you know, he's not Scarface. He's like the third guy that Scarface would hire to go and do something, and we'd see him in maybe one scene. And add on top of that, but now he's like retired. Now he's out of the game. So that's another layer of sort of weakness and unusualness that adds to this character. But yeah, just a beautifully made movie, and it is all in cinematography and the editing. That's the stuff that really sets it apart. But Terrence Stamp also delivers such good performance that it's worth watching just for him. So that brings us to my number three, and what another coincidence. I picked Haywire for my number three.
Yay.
So speaking of Len Dobbs, this is a movie that it passed right under my radar when it was when it was out in theaters. I didn't see it until it was out of theaters, but I had heard a good review of it on the Film Spotting podcast, and just listening to their review, it sounded to me like it could be, I mean, on the surface, this sounds like it could be really terrible. You know, you've got Gina Carano, who's known for her MMA fighting, and you're putting her in this like sort of spy thriller action movie and surrounding her with all these stars. It kind of, on the surface, you know, had I not known it was a Steven Soderbergh film, I would probably write this off as another one, like an attempt, like, you know, whenever John Cena tries to make a movie, or, you know, Stone Cold Steve Austin tries to make a movie, or something like that, where it's this this person who's become famous through, you know, fighting, and while wrestling is sort of like a form of performing, it's not acting to the same degree that you have to be able to act to carry a film. And so I very easily could have written this off, and had it not been for Film Spotting, I probably wouldn't have given this a second thought. But I really enjoyed Haywire. This is the one I was talking about before. It feels like a late 70s, early 80s spy action movie, right down to the, like, the grain of the film that it was shot. I think it was actually shot digitally, but they really dirtied it up to make it seem like it's, and you know, their choice of music, lots of bass, like sort of thumping bass, like you might hear in an exploitation movie. And also, the font styles and stuff, it all feels like a movie from a different time. And I mean, I loved that on the surface, but then it turns out that this spy story is actually, like, really intelligent. It's really smart and tightly done, and it's compelling. It really sucks you in. And in a way, you know, the star-studded cast surrounding Gina Carano, it does serve the same purpose that you know, a star-studded cast in, like, a John Cena movie or something like that would, which is, okay, you know, if you don't know the star, at least you will know who Bill Paxton and Channing Tatum and Antonio Banderas and Michael Douglas and Michael Fassbender and Ewan McGregor are, right? But what it also means is that while Gina Carano is not the best actress, I think she does a damn fine job in this movie, and it means that she's surrounded by really good actors. And yes, I count Channing Tatum in that list. This was the movie where Channing Tatum actually gave a performance, and I thought, damn, you know, this guy's actually okay. He's pretty good. Prior to this, I'd seen him in, I think, like, G.I. Joe, and I knew he was the star of those Step Up movies, or one or two of them. But I had written him off completely. And then after seeing Haywire, I was like, you know, this guy, he can actually act. Maybe it's just a matter of giving him the right director to work with. But yeah, all of the supporting cast, they all do fantastic jobs. Gina Carano makes a solid leading lady, and the fact that this is a movie about a woman kicking a whole lot of ass is refreshing in and of itself. the character of Mallory, she does kick a lot of ass, and you really like root for her. And because Gina Carano has the chops to do action sequences, you get some really terrific action sequences. I did not expect Haywire to contain some of my favorite action sequences of like the past 10 years. And they're all these really like visceral fight scenes where there's no non-diegetic sound. There's no background music covering it up. There are no artificial sounding sound effects. It sounds like they just recorded these fights live. And as a result, every hit seems really painful. And it's the actors actually doing it themselves. So when you see Michael Fassbender get slammed into a glass shelf and you hear all the glass shatter and the hollow thumps of her fists on his chest, like it is, she's really kicking his ass. You really believe that she is beating the crap out of this guy. And that in and of itself is just such a refreshing and interesting experience. What more can I say? I really enjoyed this one. I found it satisfying down to the last minute. And the fact alone that Haywire actually made me think that Channing Tatum could act is, that is reason for praise. But I could dedicate a whole podcast to this movie. There were so many neat little moments that I love. Even the opening scene in the diner, and there's like a little back and forth fight where a gun is like fired into the floor right next to her head. It's just all so well done that I was sucked in from the get-go. What do you think of Haywire?
Yes, I definitely like this film a lot. It didn't crack my top five, but I feel it's really solid. I felt the same thing as you when I first heard about it. It's like I see this MMA star like breaking into like action movies and stuff, and I'm kind of thinking it's almost like this year's equivalent. Oh, it's something like The Last Stand or something. It's a generic action movie thrown out in to theaters in January because they don't expect it to do very well. But then I see it's directed by Steven Soderbergh and has this amazing like A-list cast surrounding her. And it's like, okay, this is going to be better than I expected. And then I saw it was written by Len Dobbs, and I'm like, oh, it's a reunion from The Limey. And I think that, like, kind of the plot in this one is kind of a bit flawed. It's kind of confusing, and it's tough to get involved in it. But, like, the action scenes in it are just so kick-ass and stuff. Like, Gina Carano, she is kind of a wooden actress when it comes to reciting dialogue, but in the action scenes, she is just amazing. And I think the big highlight is her hotel room fight scene with, like, Michael Fassbender. Like, it kind of blew me away because Fassbender had just come off of giving like his like big acclaimed performance in Shame, and I never really thought of him as like an action star, but he like totally like held his own in like that hotel room sequence, and I kind of wish Fassbender would become an action star, because even though he's too good an actor for that, he really does hold his own well in action scenes. And and the movie has another action scene that we didn't touch upon was the big chase scene in the middle of the woods with Michael Angaranos like absolutely terrified there in the back sheet because she's just like plowing into police cars and driving backwards to try to escape and stuff. It's a really cool scene as well. And also Channing Tatum, like Soderbergh has done a lot for this guy's career because he's also given him solid roles in Magic Mike and Side Effects, and watching him in this, you're like, wow, he's not bad. He's way better than I expected. And another moment in this film that I love is the last scene where Antonio Banderas is alone in his house, and then she suddenly appears out of nowhere, and the last shot of the movie is him going, shit, and then they just cut to the end credits. I love it, just the implications of what's going to happen. So yeah, this one, I don't think it made a lot of money. It is kind of underrated, but it is really solid, and it just shows Soderbergh taking what could be a routine action film and elevating it with like his sense of style and his unconventional way of shooting action scenes.
It's funny because we've already said this a few times during the podcast, but it's so funny. Soderbergh makes this deliberate attempt to not be his own brand, to, you know, not take the possessory credit and not, advertise himself as, you know, a film by Steven Soderbergh, just so that he doesn't become associated with only one type of film and people don't get sick of him. But it seems like in spite of that, his name is what attracts people like you and I to so many of these projects. Haywire would have been something that we'd just written off if it had been given to any other director. Well, maybe not any other director, but certainly many other directors. If Len Wiseman was directing Haywire, would you have any desire to see this? No. But the fact that it's Steven Soderbergh doing this interesting, like, star-studded action thriller film in the style of like an 80s spy movie. Like, oh, I'm so there. It really is something. He is his own brand, whether he wants to be or not. But I think only in a good way. Maybe not to the mainstream. Maybe only to film nuts like Robin and I. So, Robin, what's your number two?
My number two is the film that finally won Steven Soderbergh his first Oscar, Traffic. I still remember 2000 and what a big deal it was that he got two separate Best Director nominations in the same year for both Aaron Brockovich and Traffic, which kind of propelled him from like an independent filmmaker to like an A-list Hollywood filmmaker. And it was, even though it didn't win Best Picture, I believe Gladiator won Best Picture this year. Soderbergh took home like Best Director, and he kind of felt he had to get like two nominations in the same year. What an achievement that is. So I was really happy to see him win. And I really like this movie a lot. I've actually seen Traffic, the original British miniseries that it's based on. And this movie had like a really like tough job like trying to condense, I think, something like 6 or 7 hours of material into 2.5 hours. And even though I love this movie, this is the rare movie that's about 2.5 hours long where I almost wish that it could be longer because it covers so much material and so many different characters that you want to spend more time with them and learn more about them and kind of get more clarification of the plot. But it still works very well for what it is. Like, it cuts back and forth between like three different distinct storylines. And I kind of like how Soderbergh has a distinct visual look for each storyline, because you have the stuff in Mexico with Benicio del Toro where it's all colorless and grainy, and you have the stuff with Michael Douglas and his drug addicted daughter where it's shot more like gloomy and stuff and dark, and then you have Catherine Zeta-Jones's storyline where her husband's a drug lord and it's shot in California and it's more sunny and colorful, and it kind of helps you keep track of all the storylines by the visual look that each of them have. And it's got such a great cast too. Like, I believe Benicio del Toro won his first Oscar for it, and you have people like Don Cheadle, Louis Guzman, Catherine Zeta-Jones, some of his favorite actors, and you have Michael Douglas and a lot of big name actors who pop up in small roles like Dennis Quaid and Salma Hayek. And I watched this film recently, like a couple weeks ago, and it actually has quite a few before there were stars moments too. You see actors like Viola Davis and John Slattery from Mad Men pop up in like really small roles. Like, there's no wasted role in this. Every role in it is well cast and equally effective, and it does a good job of like juggling like it's all three storylines so that you're never confused. And surprisingly, it's not really preachy at all. Like, it's covering a subject like the war on drugs that could easily turn into like a big movie about speechifying, but it doesn't really do that until the very end, until Michael Douglas's big speech at the end. And even that, it's not really preachy. It covers its material subtly. And even though I compared it to the miniseries, a lot of the stuff they cut out from the miniseries, I don't really miss it. I think this film stands very well on its own. And I'm a big fan of like these multi-character stories that cut back and forth between many different storylines, and I think it does this one really well. So, yeah, I still think Traffic holds up, and it's definitely like a big turning point in Soderbergh's career where he finally won an Academy Award, and I think pretty much after this he had license to do anything he wanted, and that's kind of set his career trajectory where he goes between Hollywood blockbusters and more experimental films. And, yeah, still one of his best.
You know, Traffic is one of those movies that I recognize as being this like phenomenally made movie, but much like Darren Aronofsky and Requiem for a Dream, these like heavy, depressing movies about the perils of drug addiction and how they can just ruin everything, and especially something like Traffic where, you know, drugs ruin everything for a lot of these characters, and it just, if the there's no real resolution to it. It's just sort of like, and that is how the world is. And you just end up walking away and you don't end up feeling great about the way the world works by the end of Traffic, at least in my opinion. So it would probably be my number six. It would definitely be within my top 10. I can certainly recognize it for a tremendous film, and I do think Soderbergh deserved, deserved all the acclaim that he got for Traffic, but it's not a movie that I'm really eager to revisit at the same time, because boy, it's not a happy picture.
No.
And it's funny because, you know, I wouldn't say that something like, I don't know, The Limey makes me really happy to watch necessarily. Like, I don't know if I'd say it evokes a feeling of happiness, but Traffic is definitely evokes a feeling of sadness. It evokes very sad emotions in me, and as a result, it'll be a while before I watch it again, but I do recognize it for being a great piece of cinema.
It could have been worse, though, because apparently the original ending was Erica Christensen's character. She finally goes into rehab, and then she escapes again because she can't beat her addiction. But they finally decided, well, we got to have a hopeful note at the end, so she finally reconciles with her father, and they go to rehab together. But it could have been a lot worse.
Fair enough. Does the series really leave you feeling even worse than the movie?
It's true. It does, because the daughter in the original series did not beat her addiction. She just went back into her downward spiral, and the story didn't really end up well for anyone, unfortunately.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
So my number two, this is it. I mean, I on our minutes, I had initially listed this as being one of the items that we'll talk about after our top fives, but Side Effects is my number two. This is another one that I just had a chance to watch recently, and wow, what a great movie. We'll talk about the implications of Soderbergh's retirement in relation to this movie once we're done our top 10, but I really wish Soderbergh had done more movies like Side Effects now that he's considering retirement, because all the comparisons to Alfred Hitchcock that other reviewers have made, they're all true. This is like a terrific noir thriller about like the depths of human depravity and psychology and all those creepy things inside us all that Hitchcock really loves to explore. Side Effects explores them really well. And it's just such an interesting movie the way it's laid out, because the two main characters are undoubtedly the ones played by Rooney Mara and Jude Law. And during the first act of the movie, I could not understand why they were giving Jude Law's character so much emphasis, because it really just seemed to me like Rooney Mara's character's film. Like, it seemed like that her character was supposed to be at the center of it. But by the end, I felt like it was really Jude Law's character's film, and that transition occurred in a way that made a lot of sense. By the end, it really did feel like it was justified in making the focus Jude Law's character rather than Rooney Mara's. But, just a terrific intrigue. I'm still processing the big reveal at the end, which I won't spoil here, because as far as I know, not a ton of people have seen Side Effects yet, and I really want to encourage it because I think it's great. I can't decide if the big reveal is perhaps a little convoluted or not, but it made sense. I didn't feel like there were any plot holes to it. But most of all, just the way that Side Effects is shot and scored, it's brilliant stuff. It is shot really, really beautifully. Soderbergh has such a good eye for cinema. He really loves to use, like, mellow, natural lighting. He's not afraid to put actors in silhouette or have them, have everything but them in very soft focus to create these really neat camera effects. And there were some shots, like, there's a really good shot near the beginning of the film where Rooney Mara's character steps on the gas in her car, and it's like the camera is the gas pedal. Her foot comes right down onto the viewer, onto the camera lens. And something like that, like, to me, that evokes the filmmaking techniques of Orson Welles and Citizen Kane, or really creative filmmaking techniques like Hitchcock was using during his time. Once again, Channing Tatum delivers a pretty good performance, and it surprises me every time I say that. Rooney Mara is great here. This really, before this, I had seen her in The Social Network, but I hadn't really remarked on her because she was just in like one scene. And I'd seen her in David Fincher's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and I thought she was amazing in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. So I was very curious to see her in another starring role by another sort of prestigious director like Steven Soderbergh, and see how it compares to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And I think she's great. She really does feel like, I know a lot of comparisons have been made between her and Audrey Hepburn, but she does feel sort of like a starlet of that caliber. I've thought she was really, like, she acted really well, and the differences between her character in Side Effects and her character in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo are so vast that I know when I revisit The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I'm going to be even more amazed, because, I mean, it's just so wildly different from who she apparently is, which, it, at least in terms of her looks, is certainly closer to Side Effects. Jude Law's great. I wish I could say I liked Catherine Zeta-Jones more, but, I mean, maybe that's just because I'm not a huge Catherine Zeta-Jones fan. But overall, yeah, I really loved this movie, and as I say, you know, I hope Soderbergh does another, like, Hitchcockian psychological thriller before he retires, because, boy, would that be great.
So yeah, I gave my opinions on Side Effects a couple weeks ago when I saw it in theaters, and I liked it quite a bit too. It didn't crack my top five, but it's definitely in my top 10, and it just shows like Soderbergh totally like defying your expectations, because going into it, watching the first half hour or so, it just seems like a story like of a woman dealing with depression, and of course it's kind of downer, but then it suddenly becomes a thriller. You don't even know you're watching a thriller like at the outset of it, but as I was watching it, I thought the Hitchcock comparison was appropriate, and it just like all I could think of myself is, you know, they just don't make thrillers like this anymore, because it's one, it doesn't insult the audience's intelligence, and it's one where like the actions, the characters actually make sense for the most part, and it's the kind of thriller I like, where like moments that you were introduced to in the first like half hour or hour or something that you thought were insignificant wind up becoming like a prime importance to the plot, and it just unfolds very nicely. Like it just occurred to me, like you used to see those type of thrillers all the time throughout the 60s, 70s, or 80s, but they just don't, you just don't see them anymore. But this one is like really solid, and it has terrific performances all around. Like another great showcase for like Rooney Mara, and great work from Jude Law. Like you said, for the first half hour or so, you're wondering, why is this character getting, like, top billing? Like, he doesn't seem to, like, get, like, a lot of focus at all. But then he does the terrific role as, like, I guess he's kind of the man, the innocent man wrongly accused. Like, he's not really wrongly accused of a crime, but he finds that he's kind of been used and is really going down, like, a bad path that he doesn't really deserve, and you kind of sympathize with him as he tries to unravel the plot. And since the movie is so recent, I don't want to spoil too much for it, because that is one of the big pleasures of the movie, is just watching the plot unfold. But I guess it did okay at the box office, but I guess it wasn't a huge hit, and I know that, I guess that's kind of the case with Soderbergh films, is that they don't really, with the exception of stuff like Ocean's 11 and Aaron Brockovich, his movies do not really appeal to the mainstream and make a lot of money, but that's okay. He doesn't really care about that. He just wants to make the type of films that he wants to make, and I guess he wanted to close out his career with like a Hitchcockian film, and if it is like the last film of his career, then he at least went out on a really good one. So yeah, thumbs way up for it. It's definitely one of his better films.
I really hope that we'll be seeing it pop up at the next Oscars somewhere, because I loved so many aspects of it. This is sort of like the perfect showcase of Soderbergh's talent as director, I believe he did the cinematography for this one, and also editing. So Robin, what is your number one?
Well, my number one is a film that I did a Robin's Underrated Gems for recently, and that's Out of Sight. I got compelled to revisit this one after seeing Side Effects, and it's definitely my favorite Soderbergh film. This is a film, it's definitely more well-known than The Limey, but I still think it's very underrated, because it got very good reviews, but it did only modest business at the box office, and it's kind of forgotten about today. But rewatching it, I just think it's one of those films where it's just perfect in every way. It just pushes all the right buttons. I still remember when this film came out in the 90s. Like, this was during the era where everyone was kind of trying to emulate Tarantino, so they wanted to adapt a lot of Elmore Leonard novels, because Elmore Leonard was obviously one of Tarantino's inspirations. And this is definitely, I think, the best adaptations of one of his novels. It actually improves upon it quite a bit. I've actually read the original novel, but I still remember the career trajectories of the stars were like George Clooney. He had just gone from ER to becoming a movie star, and people weren't sure if he had the chops to really be like a full-fledged movie star, but this movie proved it, and because he delivered such a great charismatic performance. And it's interesting to look back at Jennifer Lopez, because this is definitely her career peak, because she delivers a great performance here, and people thought she was going to become like a big A-list actress, but it's kind of gone downhill since then. But she is genuinely good in this, and her chemistry with like Clooney in it is terrific. I particularly love the sex scene that Soderbergh shoots between them, where he intercuts between their antics in the bedroom where they're playfully undressing with a conversation they're having with each other in a bar. It's just another great example of Soderbergh shooting all his scenes unconventionally. And this was kind of the film that kind of propelled him from like the king of independent cinema to the mainstream. Like, he didn't really achieve A-list status till Aaron Brockovich in Traffic, but this was him trying to make like a Hollywood movie with like A-list stars, and he did a marvelous job. Like, watching back on it, the plot is just like so well structured, and there are just so many great lines of dialogue, and a lot of the stuff that I love about Elmore Leonard. Like, there are no like boring generic characters here. Every character is like colorful in their own little way, and there's such a terrific cast with people like Bing Rames and Don Cheadle and Dennis Farina, and a lot of unconventional casting. I particularly like Albert Brooks playing this like Wall Street embezzler who's virtually like unrecognizable in his role. And another thing I like about it is that this came on the heels of Jackie Brown, so they give a cameo to Michael Keaton playing the character of Ray Nicolette, who was just in Jackie Brown, because he's a character that pops up in both the original novels. And apparently he asked Michael Keaton after Jackie Brown came out, do you want to come and make a cameo of playing the same character? And he was like, sure. And it's a really cool moment there, just tying the two films together. And it's just one of those films I can't really hammer down what is so great about it, but I just think I can't think of anything wrong with it, anything bad with it. It's just like every scene is perfectly written and acted and directed, and it just knows how to push all the right buttons. And it even leads up to a very unconventional like ending, which with a surprise cameo that is still, it doesn't go where you're expecting, but it still winds up being satisfying. So yeah, watching it all these years later, I think it holds up remarkably well. I'd rank it almost up there with Tarantino's prime films from like the 90s, and yeah, I can't think of anything bad about it. It's definitely my favorite Steven Soderbergh film.
Well, this is probably no surprise, but it's my favorite Steven Soderbergh film as well.
I figured that.
This is the movie that introduced me to Soderbergh's work. It came out right around the time that I was, you know, I've loved movies basically my entire life. I've been watching, you know, my dad was taking me to the movie theater when I was very young. So I loved movies my whole life, but I saw Out of Sight right around the time that I was starting to take film very seriously and starting to sort of break down and analyze and critique movies before having gone to university to study film theory and like learn film history. And, you already put it so well, Robin. It's the kind of film where it's hard to pinpoint exactly what works so well about it, but nothing doesn't work about it. Like, it works, and it's tightly scripted, and everything is compelling about it. All the scenes are really interesting, and it swings wildly from comedy to crime thriller to romance. Robin, you and I have such similar tastes on this one, because you even mentioned my favorite scene, which is the dinner scene / the sex scene, where it cuts back and forth between this conversation that the two protagonists are having and this very playful sex scene. And It's so unique, not only in the way that it's shot, like, oh man, it's so beautifully lit, that scene. I feel like if I were a film professor, or if I was, you know, teaching someone about the art of cinematography, I would reference that scene a lot just because I love how it's lit, how it's shot. I love how certain little moments, he does these little like freeze frame moments that they're just for a second, but to highlight little, just these little details. And, it all comes together so beautifully. And then to intercut it with a sex scene that is not a conventional Hollywood sex scene. It's a sex scene, frankly, it's one of the only sex scenes that I can think of off the top of my head where the people in it, like, it's not that they're passionate for each other. It's that they're just so happy to be together. You know, like, there's a shot of Clooney taking off his pants where he's just sort of smirking and goofing around. And it's the kind of thing where, like, you feel that kind of chemistry, and it feels like a more genuine kind of chemistry than the sex scene that opens with, you know, the two characters, like, one slamming the other against a wall, and they're just making out and slobbering all over each other. Here's one where it's much more subtle, but the emotions feel so much more real. There are all sorts of great moments. I love the bits with Jennifer Lopez in the trunk of the car, and, another sort of common theme that it's something that turns up like a motif in a way throughout Soderbergh's films that I really took note of for the first time in Out of Sight was pallid sunlight, like the gray winter sunlight that seeps through the windows and it just casts a particular kind of light on everything. Soderbergh seems to really love that because there's a lot of it in Haywire as well. And I'm pretty sure I've seen it in some of his other movies. I just can't think of off the top of my head. But that pallid sunlight, it has such an interesting mood associated with it. Like the idea of, you know, the cold. You can feel the cold of a winter day that has that pallid sunlight when you see it on film. I guess not much. There's not much I really can add that that you haven't already said, Robin, because you've touched on just so many of the good points about it. I'm trying to remember, like, Ving Rhames. I really liked Ving Rhames in this, I do love the fact that this makes such a good companion piece to Jackie Brown, especially with the through line of Michael Keaton as Ray Nicolette. It's interesting to watch Jackie Brown in Out of Sight, sort of in close proximity to each other, simply because it really shows how Elmore Leonard's writing remains consistent even when you've got two different directors, Tarantino and Soderbergh, with two very distinct styles. Like for all that you could say that Out of Sight is imitating Tarantino's style, it does have that distinct Soderbergh feeling to it in the way it's shot, in the way it's edited, just in the visual look of it. And yet both films feel cohesive as well because of the commonalities, the common characters, and the characters established by Elmore Leonard. So, all around, just an absolutely terrific film. And I'm glad it got the Robin's Underrated Gems treatment as well, because it's one that I feel like a lot of people have forgotten about. But to me, this is sort of like it's sort of like a case study of how to make a really unique movie that sort of defies all convention but still works really, really well.
One more thing I forgot to mention is this movie has one of my all-time favorite death scenes with the character of White Boy Bob, where he trips while running up the stairs and accidentally blows his own brains out. And rewatching it, I realized how well they set that gag up, because throughout most of White Boy Bob scenes, you can see him like stumbling and tripping. And this, so you realize that the whole tripping while going up the stairs is not just some cheap gag. It actually is a payoff to a long running gag. And just the fact that he winds up blowing his own brains out is just hilarious. I can watch that scene like 1,000 times and still laugh every single time.
Yeah. Amazing stuff. I really do love the comedy in Out of Sight. I like the bits where it's Jack Foley, Clooney's character, robbing a bank without even owning a gun. You know, like he can talk his way into getting money and getting whatever he wants because he has that charisma and that talent. But then some mundane crap trips him up, like he can't get the car to start. It's all just, it's very unique and very interesting. And I haven't read the novel by Elmer Leonard, but I'd be very interested to read it and do this comparison to the movie to see how much of it is like Scott Frank's screenplay, how much of it is the performances, how much of it is what is drawn from the performances by the director, and what is Elmer Leonard's, you know, awesome writing as well. Do you have the DVD of this one, Robin?
Oh, yes.
And does it have a commentary track on it?
Yeah, it does. And it's a lot nicer than the one on the Limey. I actually found out that Scott Frank came up with the ending. The novel actually ends with Karen Sisko arresting Jack Foley and sending him back to prison. But he came up with a clever ending where she puts him in a transport van with this surprise cameo by Samuel Jackson as an escape artist. So it implies that he's going to help Jack escape before they make it to their destination. It's a nice ambiguous ending that doesn't betray the characters at all.
That's really cool, because I really like the ending, and I really love the Sam Jackson cameo as well. Sort of another connection to Tarantino, too. So that wraps up our favorite Steven Soderbergh movies. So now let's talk a little bit about Soderbergh's announcement that he is going to retire. And I think he has sort of retracted that statement. He's confirmed that he would retire from filmmaking to explore painting. However, Soderbergh, a few weeks after issuing that statement, downplayed his earlier comments, saying he's taking a filmmaking sabbatical as being more accurate. So maybe he's retiring, maybe he isn't. At some point, he's going to retire to focus on painting, which is kind of surprising. But Soderbergh is not the only filmmaker to announce his imminent retirement. Tarantino just recently announced that he wants to retire from filmmaking soon. I don't know if he's specified how many more movies he's going to make, but certainly, you know, it seems like both these guys are going to retire very soon. And it's interesting that they're both going to retire so soon, because they were both sort of like the filmmakers of the 90s, these early 90s indie filmmakers who made it big. Back in the day, I'd consider Kevin Smith alongside these guys, but Smith has taken a much different route. So what do you think of the announcement that Soderbergh's going to retire?
Well, it's interesting. Like, he's not a guy, like, in the case of Kevin Smith, he was someone who wanted to retire because he was just so sick of dealing with distributors and the studio system and stuff screwing him over. But Soderbergh's a guy who has kind of free reign now. Like, he can make whatever film he wants, like, without interference. And I don't know any stories of him, like, having troubles with studios and stuff. I think most of his films, even if they don't make a lot of money, turn out the way he wants them. So I don't think it's frustration more than anything, but I kind of read the quote from him that maybe it's just burnout and stuff, where he talks about the idea of doing so much work of like getting into a van and going out and scouting locations and stuff and having to do all this pre-planning. I guess some filmmakers just get to the point where even though they're satisfied with their work, just the idea of waking up and working like 16-hour days and doing like all this scouting and stuff is just, they just get tired of it and stuff and just want to explore other avenues. But I could see him as a guy, even if he retires for a couple of years, I can see him getting the passion for it again and wanting to come back. So I'm sure that even if he does take a sabbatical, that we will see him again.
I certainly hope so, because I really do feel like Side Effects is sort of, for all that I love Out of Sight as my favorite Soderbergh movie, Side Effects is definitely, well, of course, my second favorite. It's right up there. And I feel like if he can still be this good, this far into his career, then he can't be ready to retire. You know, he's talking about feeling uninspired, about having to get up and, oh, I gotta go scout another location. But come on, man, like, look what you just did. That was amazing. You probably, didn't have that many locations. Like, I really feel like you're just hitting your stride right now. Or maybe hitting it again. But, I hope he makes more. I really do. And I don't know, it makes me sad thinking about Soderbergh and Tarantino retiring around the same time as well, because it's sort of like, who's going to take their place? They create this real dearth of auteur filmmakers that I just don't know who would fill in afterwards.
Yeah, I saw Tarantino's that he really hates the new trend to going to digital because he's such an old school film fan who likes 35 millimeters. So I think it's kind of like a lot of these guys just don't like the new Hollywood system. And it's just like, if I can't make a film my way, I just don't want to make a film.
Oh, but that's such a foolish sentiment because at least this is something that Kevin Smith understands when he made Red State outside of the studio system and distributed it himself. As I understand, that movie was pretty successful considering the distribution method and considering how so little money went towards marketing it. But, like, we are in the time of crowdsourcing and Kickstarter. And if Kevin Smith can make, like, one of the best Kevin Smiths ever, Smith movies ever made outside of the studio system, I don't see why Soderbergh and Tarantino couldn't do it. Those guys, you know, they grew up as indie filmmakers. There's no reason they can't go back to that if they don't want to. You know, fat chance. Soderbergh, Tarantino, if you're listening to this, guys, just go to Kickstarter.com and consider all the possibilities because now's the time to do it. But, yeah, you know, I hope we get at least a few more films. Three more films. I want three more films from each of these guys, and then I'll let them go. But, I'm really not ready to let them go just yet, because they're too good. Tarantino just won an Oscar for Django Unchained. Like, come on, man.
I know.
you're still good. Everyone still loves you. Make some more movies. There's no reason to stop. And as we established when we were talking about Django Unchained on previous podcasts, he can clearly just do whatever the hell he wants and get away with it. So why would you ever give that up? I certainly wouldn't.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on Steven Soderbergh before we round out the episode?
I'll just say that some other movies of his that I like that we didn't talk about is I actually still like Aaron Brockovich because I remember, like, kind of being angry. I remember when Julia Roberts, like, beat Ellen Burstyn for Best Actress, but I rewatched it last year, and it still holds up pretty well. Like, even though it is kind of a standard, like, feel-good corporate whistleblowing story, it's very well-written and still very well-acted, and I still – that's why I say this is, like, the period of his career from, like, 98 when he did Out of Sight to 2001. When he did Ocean's 11, where everything he touched turned to gold. Like, that selection of five films that he did during that time period is still one of my favorite selections of a filmmaker made during a three-year period that I can remember. And other ones I like is I do like Sex, Lies, and Videotape, his first film, which got him on the map. It's very low budget and slow, but it's well acted and, of course, very well conventional. And I also liked his movie Contagion. I thought that was pretty good as well. And Magic Mike was better than expected. That's another example of him taking Channing Tatum, a known winning actor, giving him a lead role and showing that he is a pretty good actor after all.
Yeah, I didn't see Magic Mike. Do you have any, like, short thoughts on it besides Channing Tatum was, again, surprisingly good?
Well, yeah, this is, like I said, is watching it, you don't think of it as a Soderbergh film, and that just shows what an auteur is, but it's him basically taking what could have been a really silly, campy story that was kind of like Showgirls or something, like a story of male strippers, and actually making it a very interesting drama and character study, like about someone who's been in the business of male stripping for a very long time, and he has to work up the courage to leave his comfort zone and go find something else. It's quite a different structure that I'm used to for, like, these type of films. So it just shows that when he takes a project, he doesn't do generic routine projects. He kind of does ideas with a twist, and I think that's what's so great about Soderbergh.
He seems like he's free, much like Tarantino. He is clearly free to do whatever he wants, and we just get to be along for the ride.
Yeah.
I got to agree. Brockovich is a pretty good movie. I honestly can't think of a Steven Soderbergh film that I really disliked. I think Full Frontal was kind of a misstep, but it's really interesting to look back at Full Frontal now that his career has progressed so far beyond it, especially considering that he made it right after Ocean's 11, sandwiched between Ocean's 11 and Solaris.
Yeah.
Like, what an interesting choice to make as a director. Even if you don't like the movie, boy, that's a really interesting move, dude. And again, like, way to buck trend, like, way to defy classification and just do whatever you like.
I didn't like Full Frontal very much, but I don't know if you remember it, but the big highlight of the film is a scene where they're on an airplane and Julie Roberts turns her head and sees Wilson from the Limey reciting his monologue. So it's just Terrence Stamp making this really random cameo in character as Wilson. So
it's just
kind of a bizarre crossover between the two films. It doesn't have anything to do with the movie, but I thought it was awesome.
I didn't know that at all. You know, yeah. I only saw Full Frontal at once because I don't think it's a terrific movie. But having only seen The Limey today, like, oh my God, that's really cool.
Yeah.
That instantly makes Full Frontal okay in my books.
That's true.
But like, I haven't seen the original Solaris. It's a real crime as a film nerd. But I thought Soderbergh's Solaris was a decent flick. I still need to see Che. I've heard that it is quite heavy, but another fantastic movie. And again, like, what a daring move. Make a two-part epic about Che Guevara. Wow. Yeah, you know, overall, I can't think of a Soderbergh film that I actively dislike, and most of his films I really enjoy. It does make me very sad that he's going to retire. But I think those are the only ones that I wanted to pay mention to beyond that. I clearly need to go back and revisit more of these things. After seeing Side Effects and, like, really, I mean, I loved Haywire, but it was Side Effects that really, like, revitalized my interest in Soderbergh's work. Now I feel the need to go back and watch all the movies of his that I hadn't seen before, and I still need to see. Hey, guess what? It's time for the dumb joke of the week. A guy walks into a doctor's office and says, "Doctor, whenever I have sex, my penis hurts." The doctor asks, "Can you tell me how you have sex?" The guy replies, "I guess, but your dad really should have had this talk with you long ago."
Oh, God.
Ooh. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so by emailing us. Robin can be reached by emailing robin.warder@the-back-row.com. Be sure to check out Robin's regular features, Robin's Underrated Gems, featuring The Limey and Out of Sight, and also Before They Were Stars. And I write every day at the Back Row. You can email me at gil@the-back-row.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Music for today's podcast comes to us courtesy of Vince Nitro. Feel free to email Vince at vincenitro@the-back-row.com.